Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People of Earth, attention.
Calling Tau Ceti, turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm rooting, waiting to be found, and I'm building rockets.
This is the Starship Sova. Everybody, welcome. Hello and welcome to show 730. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is fine and dandy. Tell you what's coming in today's show. We have an original to Starship Sova. Yes, our main fiction is The Glorious Tunnels of Our Gravity Dragons by Paul Jessop. And our very own Amy H. Sturgis. We're looking back at genre history. That's all coming in today's show. I do hope you will stick around and enjoy it. So I'll give you a little heads up about Paul Jessop with our Glorious Tunnels of Our Gravity Dragons. That's a great title. Paul Jessop is the best-selling video game designer and award-winning writer. He has several books out in the small press, and the latest one being Glasshouse, Skinless Man Counts Five, and Cancer Eats the Heart. With over 25 years of professional short story publications, he has had stories in Apex Magazine, Clark's World, Interzone, Nightmare, and countless others. Now, this story is narrated by Ricky Lacoste. Ricky is a longtime narrator and voice actor who has read short fiction for District of Wonders and Escape Artists Incorporated, including others. Often working alongside his daughter Isis, this story features powerful telepathic twin sisters as the protagonist. So naturally, Ricky asked his daughter Isis to help him out, and also recruited his other daughter, River, who happens to be a young aspiring stage and film actor. Special note, as far as we know so far, these real life sisters are neither telepathic nor are they able to destroy gigantic grizzly bear. I should read first the bios. Nor are they able to destroy gigantic grizzly bear bio droid using tech magic, since the opportunity has not yet presented itself. So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present
The Glorious Tunnels of Our Gravity Dragons by Paul Jessop. Read by River, Isis, and Ricky Lacoste. Ellie could sniff out a door a mile away, and Elsa had keys in her blood that could open up damn near anything. And right here, right now, Ellie's bones gave her that tingle-tingle, and she knew that there was something interesting nearby. A wormhole? Probably. Might be only another static disturbance, or maybe a light bruise on the quantum skin between worlds, and not a full-blown portal. Either way, it could spell danger, and they had to get ready. She reached over, grabbed her sister's hand, and then put a finger to her lips. Elsa nodded and rolled her shoulders back, mentally preparing herself for whatever came next. A quick link between the two of them, thoughts riding on encrypted lines broadcast from blood to blood.
Do you think the tip was right? That this might be the big one?
No way to know for sure. We should be ready, though. Just in case shit goes sideways.
A nod back and forth. Ellie had her snap blade set to go, just in case things got ugly. She looked over at Elsa and saw her twin sister's amber eyes close and her lips purse to a thin line. Her desaturated blue hair moving in the air like water, the hairs on her own arm standing up on end. The world felt electric, and she knew her sister was getting her blood all primed up and ready to roll, her complex library of reality-bending code at the ready. The circuit board tattoos on her skin glowed a faint blue that matched her hair, like sigils in the dark sparking to life. They were in the jungle tunnels under the skin of Mars. The labyrinthian halls stretched out and honeycombed for miles upon miles upon miles. From the ceiling dangled large glass jars suspended from thin carbon chains, with knotted, burly trees climbing out and seeking the artificial suns that lined the cavern walls. A glowing blue liquid sloshed inside the jars overhead with nutrient-rich food. Ellie's head buzzed a bit as she went beneath them, the static voices of the trees communicating to each other with their psychic roots. The voices were a strange cacophony of growing things and a whisper of pain and sorrow. They missed their gardeners. The undersun wasn't working correctly anymore, and their tanks were filthy, and they were so hungry.
Feed us, humans.
They said,
"Please feed us."
But were they, the sisters, even humans anymore? Ellie wasn't so sure about that. She wasn't even sure that they could be called twins anymore. They looked so different from one another, so changed through the years in vastly different ways. She had bright red hair to her sister's calm blue, and her eyes were black with white skulls for pupils. Her own tattoos were more archaic, primitive, ancient earth in look and appeal. Thick black ink, crude figures and ritual scarifications without any real functionality to them. That wasn't even touching on the various augs and splices they'd each had separately over the years.
"Sorry,"
she said to the roots of the trees.
"We're here for other reasons. Do you know what happened to your gardeners?"
She had a feeling they wouldn't, but she had to ask anyway. To her surprise, a flickering video appeared amongst her cluttered thoughts. It must have been taken by the trees themselves. The resolution was low and the image stuttered, and it had that bizarre greenish-gray tint that was the telltale signature of organic cameras. It showed people running and something large moving in the dark. A familiar fizzling pop sound, one that she recognized right away, was a wormhole opening, a big one too, from the sounds of it.
"Thank you,"
she said to the trees, and turned to her sister, whose amber eyes were now wide open and flickering like a lantern in the dark.
"Did you see that?"
"Yeah. Your tipster might have underplayed just how big this is."
And she turned to the trees, touched the roots that spilled over the glass.
"Did any of you see where the door opened?"
And they responded back in a single chorus.
No, we did not. Now either feed us or leave. We tired of these conversations.
It took longer to find the door than Ellie had first expected. They danced through the massive jungle halls and slouched through several emptied cities filled with bones covered in spit, the air scented with the sour smell of bear piss. Elsa kept asking her,
"Is it close? Why haven't we found it yet?"
And Ellie would respond through her blood waves,
"I don't know. Not much further. It must be really big if I can sense it this far back."
And so they kept on walking, the sun lamps cycling through underground day and night over and over and over again. The systems were unwinding, breaking down. The AI maintainers left to their own devices once the gardeners of Mars were gone. Elsa tried to tap into the frequencies with her sigils and various libraries of neon code, but couldn't hack on through.
"The encryption here is all busted up. No one will be able to get in, not even with a good set of keys."
That did not bode well for either of them.
"What do you think happened here?"
Ellie frowned and said,
"You know the deal. We go in, close these invading portals, and help the natives get back on their own 2 feet. The what doesn't concern us. That's someone else's line of work in the revolution."
"It's been happening more and more lately, though. The last few times, there were no natives around by the time we got there to help out."
"I know.
This has to be the last one, right? The big one. If we can trace it back, find out where they're all coming from..."
"Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Find the portal first. Close it, track it, and then uncover the clues."
Elsa nodded.
"Is the signal still here? Is it getting weaker? Stronger? We on the right path?"
Ellie consulted the compass of her bones and almost got knocked down from the force of it. Her head rang in brief pain as she looked over towards the source of the vibrations. A giant granite cube of a library sticking out of the center of an overgrown garden. The corpses of several biodroids lay rotting in the flickering under sunlights, as the smell of bear piss and now a weird scent of candy sweetened the air.
"Why bears, I wonder?"
Elsa said out loud.
"The last time it was the scent of bears too, even though we didn't find any."
"Shh."
And Ellie pointed at her head.
"Use this. Come on. We don't want to draw attention."
Elsa sighed and shook her head.
"The trees can hear everything we're thinking, so why does it even matter? They broke our encryption in less than a millisecond."
"Because it matters. Come on, you know this."
"Okay, fine, okay."
It was hard to understand the scale of the library until you were up front and right next to it. Ellie felt breathless, in awe at the sight of it, almost a religious sensation overcoming her. Was this caused by the sensation from the wormhole door? Maybe. It had never felt quite this strong before, that feeling charging up her spine and bleeding out through her body in a halting electric fire. She wiped involuntary tears from her cheeks, forced a smile, and kept on moving through the rough gardens. That stench of candy and bear fowl more pungent than before. Elsa covered her nose with her palm, several fragrance sigils emitting scent-canceling vapors. They wafted over to Ellie, and she felt a brief relief from the stench and sighed.
"Are you sure you want to do that? Shouldn't you be saving your energy? This is definitely a big door."
"I know. I can feel it as well. And I've never felt them before. Is it always like this? Such an emotional, transcendent feeling?"
"A little, yes. But never this strong. Are you sure you'll have enough juice to close it?"
"It doesn't matter. The scent made it impossible to think. Blistering in my head, draining me slowly."
"Understood."
And they paused for a moment, sharing the palm back and forth. Rough tumble of lilac of fingers, and then a bright plum scent, and then nothing but palm again. Just enough to fight back the rot and sweet and bear funk, all the while soaking in that portal ecstasy and not giving in to its siren call. They're called wormholes, after all, since they say gravity dragons tunneled through them, wounding the path between worlds. They were the fastest way to travel, the Democratic Republic of Worlds controlling the paths between planets and making sure they did not clog, nor people using them illegally for war. That didn't last too long. Ellie was still not sure how someone, or some people, or something, found out how to tame the gravity dragons, but it happened. And here they were, hunting down these rogue wormholes, fixing the world that was broken.
How big do you think it is?
I honestly don't know. It looks bigger than the Ten Fox Towers of Europa, that's for sure. And that was gigantic.
This could take us forever.
Yes. Best get started now and hope it's not too much of a maze when we get inside.
She inhaled, paused for a moment, and shook her arms, trying to relax even just a tiny bit. It was all so overwhelming. The feel of the portal, the immensity of that giant granite cube that was the library, and that scent. It was all too much. They were not too far away, probably about 10-15 more minutes of walking, and that would be it. Granite steps rose up the side of the building covered in rambling ivy and stone statues of complex geometric shapes. Amber lights flickered in the sparse windows like rogue candles.
Do you think anyone is in there?
Probably not. They're too erratic, see? Like the sun lamps outside that line the caverns now? How far inside do you think it is?
The portal?
Ellie paused.
I have no clue. It's so strong now. If it's not right at the entrance, then it must be massive, larger than we've ever seen before.
It seemed like their tipster was right after all. This would be the big one, the one that they could probably trace back to the start after they close it and find out who is behind this all along. Maybe the rebellion could ride through the shadows of the wormholes, finding their way and stopping this all from getting out of hand.
But it's already out of hand.
The inside was a maze of shelves and long corridors that bent and twisted around them, bored through the granite block like anthills. Bookshelves lined with countless texts stumbled along the edges of these mazing halls, with flickering amber lanterns hung at various parts, and chairs cut into the sides for reading and hanging out. The ruins of a small autotron lay crushed over on its side. The elegant brass designs that had once lined it, now twisted and pulled from the body. It looked like something huge had stepped on it, and it smelt of burnt ozone and rotting electrical fluids. In its hands were the cracked and shattered coffee mugs and destroyed books that it was probably bringing to a patron before it got attacked. The gears lay scattered, the cracked lights of the body blinking dimly in the dark.
What happened to you, poor fella?
Elsa said, and leaned down to examine him.
Why would anyone destroy you? It seems insane. You aren't even an expensive biodroid. Just a cheap metal thing made for whimsy and entertainment.
Ellie shot her a dirty look and pointed at her head again.
Come on, speak in here.
But Elsa ignored her, so Ellie just let her have this moment without any more chiding. She felt it too, that strange sadness at the death of something that was nothing more than an amusement. Somehow, that made it all the worse. Further along, tall amber crystals lined the halls, left and right, obscuring books and crawling across the floor. Inside each were humans, people, probably those very same Martians that ended up missing. This could be why they hadn't found any bodies anywhere. They were still in the crystals, the forms glowing inside like human lanterns.
Thought melts,
Elsa said to her.
See? Look, touch it and feel.
Ellie leaned over, placed her palm on the crystal, and jumped back as sharp electric pain rang through her nerves. It felt like every single bone in her body jumped at the same time, and her mind spun, and she lost the tingle-tingle that connected her to the door they were looking for. Shit.
Yeah, definitely a thought melt. I thought those were illegal.
They are. But is anything here legal?
No. No, I guess not.
She decided not to tell her sister that she'd lost the signal to the door. It would only worry her. The maze of tunnels in the library felt pretty straightforward, and more like an old-fashioned labyrinth than a true maze. Like the kind you followed as an act of medieval meditation centuries upon centuries ago. They would just have to follow the spiral path to the center. She was pretty certain that that's where the portal was, and that would be it. She only hoped that they got to it soon. She didn't know how much more she could take of this. The scent was even stronger now, clouding her head. Elsa's palm sensor wasn't even helping much anymore to dampen it. And the door feeling was numinous and numerous, completely overwhelming all of her senses completely. It was taking all of her willpower to keep focused, to keep moving ahead, to not stop and give in and give up. And the crystals, oh, the crystals were the worst of it. Even when you weren't touching them, you could feel them leeching your thoughts out of the air, trying to suck them inside and burn your will to mush.
How are you holding up, sis? Is this sapping you as much as it's sapping me?
Elsa rubbed her eyes.
Maybe. I don't know. I think I still have enough strength to close it, but I might have to rest a bit first.
Can you even rest?
Elsa pushed her hands over her eyes, sucked in her breath, and plopped squat on the ground. She sat there like that for a moment, smiled, and moved her hands.
Like this I can. It's not the best way to recharge, that's for sure. But it will help.
Okay. Let's keep going then.
Though she was sure that they shouldn't. That maybe they should get out of here on the proper channels. And maybe use a dead link to connect to the hive, since all the links here were broken down or full of weird chatter. And then they could summon reinforcements. Get this done right away. Elsa seemed to know what she was thinking. She placed a hand on her sister's shoulder and smiled.
No. You know that's a bad idea with these people trapped here. It's only a matter of time before they're gone, like the others.
You're right. They're probably waiting for the thought melt to do the trick and then whisk them away in the wormhole like the rest.
Right.
They finally found their portal near the central spiral of the library. Massive, gigantic, crouched up against a wall as tall as several stories, chewing its way through the various floors like they were made of paper. Their heads spun with the glory of it, choral voices singing briefly in their head, spidering out in bright flashes of light. Elsa grabbed her hand and thought,
"Hold on. Hold tight. Don't let go of me. I need you to anchor me so I can..."
And before she could finish her thought, they heard a rough, loud roar that shook the floors above and below. Bits of asphalt and granite dusted down around them, coating their heads and shoulders. They moved back, hid in one corner behind a crystal body of a young child and her mother, making careful not to touch the crystal itself. The roar happened again, and they didn't say anything to each other, not even through their blood waves.
"Mr. Buttons! What has gotten you into such a tizzy? Why, I never..."
The voice was a child, a little girl, and Ellie leaned around the edge of the crystal to take a peek. Elsa pulled her back quickly and shook her head.
"No."
She then touched Ellie on her forehead with her pinky finger, drawing a quick sigil circuit, and then leaned her other hand around the corner, a sigil circuit on the palm glowing white and soaking in the world beyond. There, it projected in her thoughts this image. A biodroid, whose slurry AI neural network had been poured into the shape of a leviathan bear, cut from wood and fur and bone, bigger than any she'd ever seen in her entire life. It was the size of two bears high, easily and four wide. The body stuttered and moved in that rough marionette way that biodroids usually walked, and when it roared, it was an earthquake of sound. And skipping next to it was a 12-year-old girl with a small tiara on her head. She had silver eyes and silver hair and moon silver skin that reflected light. Her dress was red and floofy and danced around her body in tiny clouds of taffeta. Her shoes? Ballet slippers. In the center of her forehead was a tattoo of her own, one that glowed blue in the dim light of the Maisling Library, a snake eating its own tail. Where had Ellie seen that before? It felt familiar, but couldn't place it.
Why are you sniffing the crystals? Come on, Mr. Buttons, get off it. We have to let them marinate for a little while longer. The servants of the Royal Empire of 14 worlds need to be pliable, after all. Else what kind of empire would that be? Why, not even a real empire at all. So wait, be patient. Once they're done, we can push the crystals in, close the door, and be done with all of this nonsense. Won't Daddy be so proud of us? I really think he will.
And the bear shook its head back and forth, and then turned and looked directly at the two of them.
Oh, shit.
Ellie's snap blade came out, snicker snack, vorpal hum and dangerously sharp. She looked at her sister and saw the worn-out, bonked look in Elsa's eyes and knew that she barely had enough energy to keep going, let alone to get into a magical brawl or even attempt to close that door.
Wait, what do you spy over there, Mr. Buttons?
The bear growled deep and lonely.
Another Martian for us to take home with us. Why, how wonderful! Hello there! Hello! I hate to inform you, but your little social anarchist collective, or whatever you call it, is now null and void. Look around you. There is no collective any longer. You are now servants of the Holy Solar Empire of 14 worlds. You understand me? I am the one true princess of Mars, and you shall listen and obey.
Nope, she wasn't having none of this. There was no way she was going to let herself or Elsa get bundled up into one of those crystals and get brainwashed like that. Her blade at the ready, she stepped out from behind her hiding place. She stood firm and tall and gulped heavily. That bear was even bigger in person, so massive its head scraped the top of the ceiling and it barely fit into the tunnel, with tufts of fur caught along the edges. This was probably a really bad idea. So what? She was going to do it anyway. That never stopped her before. She whipped the blade back, ran forward, howling at the bear, snickersnack. Sharp cuts of light flickering fire as she let the sword bite deep, sending out sparks into the air. The bear whopped, smacked her back, big paw like a starliner, hitting her in the chest, and woof, she fell hard. Her own primitive tattoos acted as a shield and absorbed some of the blows, but not much. The nanobites in the ink just weren't potent enough, and she didn't have enough juice herself to get it any stronger. That was okay, though. This would help enough. She ran up the side of the paw, then the arm, and then its thick neck cutting along the way. Red light and shadows and a scream in the dark. And then she heard a haughty howl as the Princess of Mars threw a temper tantrum and then began climbing behind her, screaming,
"How dare you hurt Mr. Buttons! You vagabond! You cur! How dare you!"
As she threw bolts of electric nanobite fire from the glowing circuit tattoos on the palms of her hands. Bzz, 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 they zipped her ear and scorched her spine as Ellie cut down into the neck of the massive bear. It howled, tried to wrestle her away, knock her back, anything, all while she clung onto the tufts of fur as hard as she could. Electric blood squirted around them, a living ooze filled with all those tiny writhing organic neutral networks grown in code vats on the hanging gardens of Venus. It squirmed across her face, icky, maggoty stuff, and she she wiped it away, spat it out, her back burning pain from the nanobite fire as she sawed through the neck with her snap blade. It went through easy. Slick butter, no bones in that biodroid body, just vegetable gel hardened to a thick skeleton that was nothing at all. It was close to decapitation, the head hung on by slick threads of living goop and not much more, when the Princess of Mars finally got the upper hand, knocked her down to the ground, and started to choke her with her bracelet-strung arms.
How dare you! What insolence! You ruffian! You have no manners! I will teach you to respect your betters!
Her snap blade was knocked away, and the world dimmed slightly, slimming down into a pinpoint of night. Oh, come on, this can't be it. She really couldn't die like this, could she? She reached out with her mind to Elsa, to anyone.
Come on, help, please.
No response. She looked over, and Elsa was rimmed with electrical light, her body hovering a good foot off the ground, her hair moving as if it were underwater, her eyes closed. Everything felt like a dark, pale shadow. Phew! Kinetic burst of light, and then she was blind. Oh, fire and thorn, she was blind. How did that even happen? Reality felt stark and broken. Eventually, her eyesight returned, just enough to see the cold blue shapes in the world around her, and then watch as the bear vaporized into smoke and whispers. The false Princess of Mars stuttered back, shocked, her eyes wide and babbling.
I'm blind! You blinded me! You evil witch! What have you done? Where is Mr. Buttons? What have you done?
A moment, as all the color drained back into the world, Ellie leaned over, saw her sister collapsed on the floor, and all the worst thoughts spun around in her mind. Death. Elsa killed herself trying to save her twin. Oh, damn. How foolish. She concentrated, tried to see if she was breathing still, but couldn't tell from this far away. And in the distance, the false Princess of Mars howled in pain.
How could you do that to him? He was in our family for generations!
And then a scowl, and her words seemed older than her face.
You wait here with your little friend until I get back. And we'll have words. Oh, yes, we will. Just you wait. My daddy will not be pleased. And that spells trouble.
And then the 12-year-old girl, now with tattered clothes and scorch marks on her face and hands, ran through the debris-stricken hall and dove headfirst into the worm tunnel like it was a fresh pool of water. Reality rippled around it as Ellie crawled over to her sister and felt her pulse. Still there, heartbeat going strong, and her chest rising up and down, breathing heavily.
You in there, sis? Can you hear me?
And Elsa's eyes did not even open or flutter.
Shh, not so loud. I have a headache.
Which made Ellie smile.
Sorry.
And tried to whisper her thoughts.
You're out of juice, aren't you?
You think?
Everything hurts, and I think I saw death for a bit there. Yeah? What's she like?
Endearingly cute.
We need to close this portal. She said she's coming back. My guess is with an army of Mr. Buttonses. People like her don't tend to take failure well.
I know, I do, but I don't have the strength.
What if I lend you mine?
She pulled her sister up into her arms, held her tightly. Everything felt alive in the hall as the portal rippled around them, chewing into the granite edifice of the walls more and more. Somewhere, a gravity dragon roared. waking up and getting ready to tunnel some more through the quantum walls of the universe.
You don't have anywhere enough juice in you to close a door like that.
Gotta try, don't we?
And then her skin crackled like static light. And there was a feeling in her head like a communication gate was opening. At first she flinched, not wanting the intruder inside her thoughts. It insisted, grew louder. And so she relaxed and hoped for the best. And was greeted with the voice of the trees.
Close the door.
We can't.
We will lend you our power. Tell your sister to open to us. To let us in, and we will fill her with what she needs.
Will that much energy kill her? She's not a human battery.
Close the door.
She leaned close, whispered in her sister's ear.
The trees want you to open up, to let them help us out.
Weakly, her eyes still closed, Elsa nodded. Ellie closed her own eyes and felt the vibration of tree energy all around them. It was green, sparkling bright, firefly and misty in nature. She gulped, her body shaking with the strength of it. As her sister's tattoos glittered to life once more, everything felt alive with a secret fire as her head filled with the musty dreams of ancient trees. She saw it all. The first ship's landing, the giant biodroid ants digging holes through the world and creating the first jungles, and later the cities and the library. All these thoughts fluttering naked in her mind. How the trees loved those who cared for them, and the horrors of the days when the false princess of Mars showed up with Mr. Buttons. And then, snap, the door was closed. Her sister was still in her arms, yet breathing with Elsa's heart beating against her fingertips. Thup-tump, thup-tump, thup-tump. She leaned against the wall and knew it might be a while before her sister could move again. But that was okay. She had to rest, maybe sleep for a bit too. After all, this day took a lot out of her. And when they were ready to go again, they would climb back up to the outer domes on the surface of Mars and reach out for the deadlinks and call in backup. Hopefully it wasn't too late, and the Martians weren't made brain dead by the thought melts just yet. But for now, they would just rest, recuperate, and share the root-angled dreams of trees.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And there you go. Big thank you to, big thank you, Paul. Paul, thank you so much. Paul, I can remember you pushing out stories, like you say, 25 years ago, man. Wow, when even I was dabbling in the art. Man, keep on going, sir. Right, plugging away. And Ricky, big thank you, lad. Big thank you indeed. And all your brood. Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. Now, it is our very own Amy H. Sturgis, looking back genre history. Ames!
Hello, my friends. It's time for another look back at genre history. Today, I would like to start in April 2024, which is the publication date of two new works I'm very excited about. And these two works point backwards to 1826, to a work that is, in fact, one of my favorites, one that I have the great pleasure of teaching right now, and that is particularly exciting because it is a work that is very relevant to our reality today. I am talking about Mary Shelley's 1826 classic, The Last Man. There are two new books related to The Last Man that I would like to share with you. But first, let me give you a quick introduction to The Last Man and the reasons why it is getting so much attention right now. It is a great time to be reading The Last Man, as I've shared with my students. It's long been considered a classic and pioneering work. It's worth saying this before I go a step farther. When I teach Mary Shelley's Frankenstein from 1818, we discuss how this is often considered to be the first work of modern science fiction, as opposed to earlier proto-science fiction. It all fits, all the prerequisites, the necessary ingredients for modern science fiction to flourish have happened by the time Frankenstein is published, and they inform Frankenstein. I'm talking about things like the scientific revolutions, the Industrial Revolution, and the rise of Gothic literature. And Frankenstein ticks all of the boxes for modern science fiction. It asks, what if? It offers an answer with plausibility, not necessarily probability, but science fiction doesn't have to be probable. It just has to be plausible. There is an intellectual excitement about the thought experiment, engagement with the trying on of ideas. And Frankenstein, like all science fiction, considers what it means to be human and who is human. Now, here's what I want to underscore from the start. If Mary Shelley hadn't written Frankenstein in 1818, she would still be considered the mother of modern science fiction because of The Last Man in 1826. In other words, Mary Shelley wasn't a one-hit wonder, science fictionally speaking. She was a one-woman revolution. And while she was certainly writing in conversation with other works and in the context of others' ideas, the importance of these novels, Frankenstein and The Last Man, just can't be overlooked. Now, while The Last Man has been long considered a classic and pioneering work, it's also enjoying a renewal of interest and attention right now. And I want to talk about two new works that are shining the spotlight on The Last Man. But it's worth asking, why now? What is it about The Last Man that speaks to us today? Well, it's set in the 21st century, during a global pandemic, while the Earth experiences rapid environmental change. There are broken political and social institutions. Really, The Last Man has it all. And rereading it this time, I just finished a new rereading of this work, I was also struck by other relevant issues. Displaced populations, immigrant communities seeking refuge from upheaval. How warfare exacerbates all other problems. Pandemic, famine, environmental cataclysm, you name it. There's even the ripped-from-the-headlines political as well as personal woes of the British royal family. It seems like it's all there. Or, to put it another way, The Last Man is a pioneering work of eco-criticism, anticipating climate change and ecological upheaval. It's plague literature in the new age of modern science fiction. It's dystopian literature, apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic literature. It's a powerful political attack on how institutions are not only incapable of meeting great challenges, but actually exacerbating tragedies, making them worse. And remarkably, it's also, despite all of its big ideas, a deeply personal work and autobiographical novel, because Mary Shelley writes herself into the future that she has imagined. And she includes people she loved as characters as well, including her husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and her friend, Lord Byron. It is also, surprisingly, given that she has written this when she is, in fact, the last man in her own life, in a way, having survived children, family, friends, husband, many loved ones, a work of great hope. In fact, hope is so central that Eileen M. Hunt, professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, who wrote one of the books that I want to talk about, The First Last Man, Mary Shelley and the Post-Apocalyptic Imagination, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in April 2024. Hunt writes this, quote, "This book is for everyone who has suffered isolation and despair. Mary Shelley shows us the way out," end quote. A really powerful endorsement there of the hope inherent in Mary Shelley's The Last Man. But before we talk about Eileen Hunt's book, let me first mention that Penguin Classics has published a new edition of Mary Shelley's The Last Man, April 2024, and it's a really beautiful edition with a foreword by author Rebecca Solnit and an introduction by John Havard, who teaches at the State University of New York at Binghamton, where his work focuses on 18th century and romantic literature and political culture. So The Last Man is just right up his alley. And in his introduction, John Havard says, quote, "But the story of this last man is not a classic for the bookshelf, one of the great works left behind at the end of the world. This tale of mass death and tenuous survival is very much alive. In an age of political earthquakes and man-made disasters, freak pandemics, and spiraling climate catastrophe, The Last Man provides a roadmap of sorts for a world of vanishing certainties," end quote. A great statement there of the relevance of The Last Man to our world today. So, if you haven't read The Last Man, and you're looking for a good edition, Penguin Classics has you covered. And now I want to talk about Eileen M. Hunt's new book, The First Last Man, Mary Shelley and the Post-Apocalyptic Imagination. This book rounds out a trilogy of scholarly works on Mary Shelley by Hunt, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and here is the way that Hunt describes them. Quote, "The First Last Man ties together my trilogy of books on why Mary Shelley's writings, both private and public, are uncannily prescient for theorizing human responsibility for creatures, creations, and disasters of our own making. Mary Shelley and the Rights of the Child from 2018 treated her novel Frankenstein as an extended thought experiment on the duties of parents toward children, no matter how, from what, or by whom they are made. The conclusion used the novel's cascade of thought experiments on the ethics of creating life to speculate the rights of genetically modified children, or what Margaret Atwood, in her 2013 post-apocalyptic pandemic novel Mad Adam, called Frankenbabies. In Artificial Life After Frankenstein, 2021, I expounded the relevance of Shelley's twin masterpieces of political science fiction for the ethics of using technology to make genetically modified organisms, including human clones, three-person IVF babies, and gene-edited children, robots, and artificial intelligences, and, to a lesser degree, pandemics and other environmental disasters. The First Last Man, 2024, picks up this argument to explore the existential life and death question of personal and political responsibility for the spread of plagues and other contagions of misfortune." End quote. In The First Last Man, Hunt also compares and contrasts Frankenstein and the Last Man. And here I want to quote again from Hunt. Quote, Frankenstein and the Last Man are concerned with delineating the tragic emotions and unjust social consequences associated with the repeated human failure to make peace, share love, and care for others and the world at large. The gothic and domestic horror of Frankenstein arises from the destructive passion of a chemist who uses science and technology to create a human being without caring for it. The existential and global terror of The Last Man derives from its slow and devastating exploration of the personal and political betrayals that exacerbate war, corruption, and a plague that appears to leave a lone human survivor who lives to write the history of the near extinction of his species. End quote. In The First Last Man, Hunt points out that Mary Shelley achieved multiple firsts in her novel. For example, The Last Man is about a fully global and lethal pandemic, not, as in previous plague literature, about a local pandemic or a contagion that is affecting one particular population. Philosophically speaking, it's also a first because, and I'm going to quote Hunt again here, quote, her distinctive, that is Mary Shelley's distinctive, philosophical contribution to plague literature was to conceive all plagues, real and metaphorical, as human contaminations of their wider social environments. Bad human behaviors corroded the people closest to them, then spread like toxins through the cultural atmosphere to destroy the health and happiness of others, end quote. This goes back to the idea that the plague that is described in The Last Man moves through lots of other human mechanisms like warfare, like conquest, like political corruption and ineptitude. And so bad human behaviors and broken human institutions aren't just failing to rise to the challenge or challenges, they're actively making things worse. And not only do I recommend Hunt's book because it's a fascinating analysis of one of my favorite novels, The Last Man, but I'm also recommending it because it connects The Last Man to later science fiction works of interest. Just a few she mentions include H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds from 1897, M.P. Shields' The Purple Cloud from 1901, Richard Matheson's I Am Legend from 1954, Joanna Russ's The Female Man from 1975, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale series from 1985 to 2019, and Mad Adam series from 2003 to 2013, Octavia Butler's Clay's Ark from 1984, and Parable series from 1993 to 1998, and Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11 from 2014, and Sea of Tranquility from 2022. There are some compelling through lines linking Frankenstein to The Last Man and The Last Man to contemporary science fiction from the 20th and 21st centuries. So I share all of this at a time when I have just reread The Last Man. I've lost count of how many times I have read The Last Man, but it is a work that continues to just reach out to me wherever and whenever I am and speak to my experience and my world in a powerful way. I find new resonances in the work every time I return to it. I highly recommend it, and I'm so excited to spend a month sharing it with students. But I'm also really excited that it is gaining new attention and is newly accessible yet again. So, with that, I point you toward Penguin Classics' new edition of The Last Man, published in April 2024, and also published in April 2024, Eileen M. Hunt's new work, The First Last Man, Mary Shelley and the Post-Apocalyptic Imagination, from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And while I'm throwing in recommendations, if you are interested in an academic edition of The Last Man, one with comprehensive annotations and appendices of extra materials that contextualize the novel, then I recommend Broadview Press's edition, edited by Anne McWhirr. That is sort of the gold standard. So, FYI. I hope this has been of interest, and I look forward to joining you again soon for something completely different when we get together to take another look back at genre history. Thank you.
And there you go. Big thank you, Amy. Oh, big hugs. Big hugs. Thank you so much. Honestly, I'm not joking. It means a lot. Thank you so much. So that is Starship Sova's 700, and I've lost the count there, 730. Yes, now if you want this show without any ads spoiling it, so you can just get lost in the kind of, lost in the imagination of some great writers, pop over front of the webpage there. There's a Patreon link, and that'll just get you no more adverts. Be fantastic. That's what, and they'll just keep this show going as well, so that would be fantastic. Until next time, I'd just like to say good night from me.
Thank you for listening.
I don't get out much. I've barely left the ground. I'm tuning into your transmissions. I'm ruining, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets, pointing them to the moon. But the work is going slowly. It won't get to you anytime soon. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here, and at best I'm moving slow. So I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. Thank you.
Thank you.